This is GabFest Radio, a weekly program about politics and culture from Slate and WNYC. On this week's Political GabFest, will the shutdown permanently alter the dynamics of American politics, or are we doomed to repeat it? Also, Facebook changes its privacy settings for teenagers, and Emily is outraged. I'm David Plotz.
And I'm Stephen Metcalf. On this week's Culture GabFest, the winner of this year's Nobel Prize for Literature is the Canadian short story writer Alice Munro. What does her win mean for Canadians, for the short story, for literature, and for the Nobel Prize? Then we'll explore what the SAT's 8-year-old essay section means for how writing is taught to high school students. And then Captain Phillips stars Tom Hanks as a modern-day victim of pirates.
The ship's broken.
Captain, no one get hurt if you don't play no game.
We'll start with the Political GabFest right after the news.
Hello and welcome to GabFest Radio from Slate and WNYC. I'm David Plotz in Washington. The epic showdown in Washington is over and the Republicans lost. How the shutdown fiasco will shape the 2014 election and alter the Republican Party? And will it end debt ceiling hostage taking forever? And then, what happens when Facebook changes its privacy settings to allow teenagers to post more? Joining me in Washington is Slate's chief political correspondent, John Dickerson. Hi, John.
Hello.
And from New York today is Slate senior editor Emily Bazelon. Hi, Emily.
Hey, David.
Now that the shutdown is over, has the political landscape shifted? The ordeal of the last few weeks appears to have traumatized almost everyone concerned, but memories are short. The Tea Party caucus is still very popular at home in its home districts. The elections of 2014 are still pretty far away. And there's another debt ceiling deadline coming sooner than you think. And Obamacare is also still a mess. So let's talk about the future of politics and whether what just happened is going to have any effect on it. So, Emily, can the debt ceiling be used as a weapon again?
I don't think it can, not in the short term. I think that's the one thing the country won. It just has been such a boomerang for the Republicans. I just can't imagine that in 3 months they're going to want to put themselves through this again. And so in that sense, I hope that it's been shelved for the time being. John, please, please.
John is not going to agree with you.
I don't think I can stand this.
I think that's probably right. Although I guess my hesitation is the country was not necessarily, at least based on the polling, fully behind the president's claim of not wanting to negotiate on the terms of the debt ceiling. People actually did want some spending reductions to be married with a raising of the debt ceiling. What the Republicans did, though, is they decided to launch a tactical attack based on perhaps scientific study of the one gambit people were even less excited about. They just picked something people were just hated. And so we never really got to get to the question of whether the president was on the wrong side of that argument. So let's say 3 months from now, we're into a fight about taxes and spending and entitlement cuts. The Republicans are not unified. They don't have a good spokesman. They've just had this bad thing they've been through. But 3 months from now, if the Republicans get back on the conversation, they talk about spending in a way that people find appealing, the president might find himself under more pressure than he did in this instance. I still think that it would be awfully hard for Republicans to use this again. But, you know, as David quite rightly pointed out at the beginning, memories are short and weird things happen. And I think we found that basically when we thought big events have happened in politics that will really change the game, it doesn't really change the game.
Right. And so what are the terms? What are the terms? Please ignore the woman crying, weeping in the corner. What are the terms?
Weeping in the background.
What are the terms of political, or not the terms, what is going to be under discussion in the next few months? So we did not resolve any of the fiscal issues. There's still going to be big discussions about the sequester, about tax reform, although tax reform basically seems to be a non-starter because everything meaningful requires getting rid of deductions that they never get rid of, and entitlement changes, some of which are cuts, things like change CPI and means testing Medicare. And also there's immigration reform is still sitting there back there somewhere as well. So, John, where do you see the negotiations going? Do you think there's any room for a compromise? First of all, on the question of the sequester, like the sequester in January, a second set of sequester cuts would go forth, which would squeeze discretionary spending, both in defense and in domestic spending. I do not see any universe where that doesn't happen.
Yeah.
I bet that stuff goes through.
Yeah. So the problem is that the way it wouldn't happen is if you found the savings elsewhere. And what Republicans have said is, let's just take the cuts the president has already agreed to, JNCPI, means testing, and Medicare, and use the savings from those cuts, and we'll slip them into the savings we were going to get out of sequestration. The White House doesn't think that's a fair deal because they think Republicans don't want the sequestration cuts either. They don't. It's just Democrats hate those cuts even more. I don't know what the shape of the deal is. I mean, one of the things about tax reform, the reason everybody always reaches for a grand bargain is you could stuff a lot of exciting things into a grand bargain. And that's sort of true of tax reform, too. You can hide some stuff in tax reform. You can get revenue in tax reform that you can kind of, if you bend your back the right way, allow yourself not to call a tax increase. So there is some attractiveness to tax reform because of its utility in finding an agreement. The problem with tax reform is that once you say the word, if we were to open the studio, there would be a line of 18 lobbyists here to argue whatever it was that was going to be in the next sentence, because it's a hugely consequential topic for lots of people with interests in Washington. And so it's a tricky thing to do, even though Dave Camp, chairman of the Ways and Means Committee, and Max Baucus, the chairman of the Finance Committee in the Senate, have been working on tax reform for a long time, like 3 years. So they've done a lot of the work. But what that hasn't been done is the political work. And that's the trickiest part of tax reform, too, because everybody feels like they're getting screwed. And you know, nobody wants to get screwed.
Let's switch to the politics of it, to the raw politics, because I know that's where John wants to be with the horse race. So we have a Senate that's up for grabs in 2014, a House that really is not up for grabs. I don't think anyone thinks that even if the dynamics of politics have shifted even a significant amount, I don't think anyone thinks that the Democrats have a reasonable chance of capturing the House. Nothing that happened in the last month changes that in a significant way. Maybe there's a marginal district or two that Democrats are going to win that they wouldn't have won, but does not seem like they can claw back a majority there. The Senate is the open question. There are a whole bunch of, you said there are 10 contested races, John. 9 of them are seats that are currently occupied by Democrats. Do you think that what just happened changes any of those races significantly?
And we should note that the 10th in that list, the one Republican who's even possibly in danger, although she's not in danger at all, is Susan Collins, who is making a real effort to promote her role as the bridge builder here. I think in the House, I think you're right. I think this will help with fundraising and there will be flares. But the Senate question is the interesting one. And basically, the question is, how does the GOP civil war play out in those Senate races? Do the Senate races become ones in which, you know, Ted Cruz shows up and Sarah Palin shows up and the candidates running on the Republican ticket in order to garner the enthusiasm that flows through those two figures has to say all kinds of exciting things that are incendiary and that are out of phase with where people are in the state. That will continue what was roiled up here as a part of the shutdown. I think if it's just about the shutdown, I think the candidates basically are able to survive that if you're a Republican, both because of time and also because it'll just turn to be about like kind of local kind of issues. So, but it just kind of depends on how much the war inside the party keeps kind of bouncing along.
But do you think the war inside the party is going to be as at such a fevered pitch as it's been?
I mean, when Ted Cruz is giving his press conference at the same time Mitch McConnell's giving a press conference announcing the deal has been made and Cruz is bashing the establishment and McConnell is essentially a stand-in there for the establishment, I do think that's as somebody said, it's like giving a finger to the party. Like, it's a pretty bold move. And so will he continue having those kinds of fights? And will he have any currency? He's, you know, of the winners and losers here, Ted Cruz is a loser in terms of the commentariat. He is definitely not going to win the position as the majority leader of the New York Times editorial board. But the people who support him, the people who believe Republicans have sold out the cause in Washington over the last many years and never stand up for principle, are delighted that he stood up for principle under withering fire. So he's glowing both because he's radioactive to one group, but because he's also a savior to another group.
My overwhelming sense, Emily, coming out of this is, why on earth would anyone want to be in the House of Representatives or the Senate? Maybe if you're Harry Reid or Mitch McConnell, maybe then it's a decent job. Otherwise, it just seems like the worst, worst job in the world. You don't have any power. You spend your days doing really stupid stuff. Everyone hates you. Not only have they devalued government and made people hate government, they've made politics an even less attractive profession than it ever seemed before.
It does seem pretty loathsome right now. I mean, the institution as an institution looks so terrible. And I guess if you're Cory Booker, who just got elected to the Senate from New Jersey, this isn't exactly the most auspicious beginning. And yet, if you are interested in the national political scene, it's the only place to be. It's the stepping stone. You can, you know, go run for governor and prove that you can run something in your own state. But then you have to translate that somehow into a vehicle to run for president if what you really want is to get to Washington. And then you spend more time in the hinterland.
Think about Cory Booker. Cory Booker, mayor of Newark, has had a really active life. He get, you know, obviously he does a lot of speaking and you know, he's a celebrity and so forth. But he comes to Washington, he's just another person being a blowhard, another person working on bills that will never get passed in a body that cannot do anything. Why on earth would you want that job?
Maybe he won't keep it that long, either because he'll somehow move up the ranks or he'll go back and become governor after Chris Christie's been done being governor. I mean, there aren't that many moves you get to make once you're in this sort of heady world of prominent national or head of state politics, right?
And also there are a lot of ways, I mean, particularly for a senator, you can do with constituent service where you can actually help people. A phone call placed here or some pressure there
on.
To help people who,
come on, John.
You know, who don't have, what, people who are, you know, they're not getting their Social Security checks. You make that
yeah,
happen.
Yeah, if you're
they're
mayor,
not...
you really get to do that. If you're in Senate, yes.
Right, but my point is, okay, so.
Sure,
but
you have people who deal with constituent service.
Well, I wasn't done
big
with
deal.
The total list of the things they could do. So then if you're on the Intelligence Committee or the Committee on Foreign Relations, you get to be involved in international affairs and in the mix of the discussions of that, which are personally enlivening. And then also you get to like try and work on these other things, which, you know, you don't think government is going to be permanently screwed. Maybe if you're, you know, I guess if we're here for another five more years and we're into like our 10th year of this government fishtailing, then maybe so. But you are full, your days are full of purposeful conversations with people trying to figure out solutions. And while that gets frustrating, you can kind of keep engaging in these conversations so that you like can kind of think you're still moving things along. They are fed by daily conversations with intelligent people working on, you know, education reform or infrastructure. And though they know at the end getting the final bill signed might be hard, they can do 90% of the work, which for them, because they're actually interested in the ideas, they actually, I mean,
but it's like being a doctor and you're like, you're in the doctor's office, you're a physician, you get patients and they're quite ill. And you say, you know, what you really need is you need to take this medicine. You know, we need to do some surgery on you. We need to set this broken bone in a cast. And the patient's like, great, let's do it. And then you're like, well, we can't actually do any of those things. But I think that's what we should do. If we could do it, it would be really good. You really might get better. It's an unbelievably frustrating kind of job.
It's incredibly frustrating. But I think
along the way, you work in a really nice office. People tell you how important you are and you get to go on TV a lot. So
yeah, but
you
that's
can
just
sort of pad.
Yes,
the,
it's just
I know, but
it's
I
bull.
But I don't think that. Right. Yes. And yet.
Would you ever take such a job?
I can't handle any of this. I mean,
it's a
I
job
have zero
that only
patience.
Rewards glory. It's pure ego.
You know, actually, that's not true. So, for example, in the Senate, right after the president was elected, they passed this big healthcare law. There are like millions and millions of people who will now be covered,
millions
who were
millions.
Not covered before, and whose life is materially changed by now having health insurance. There are a lot of senators who were involved in that process who probably feel pretty good about
yes,
that.
Yes, I'm sure they do. That
so
was
it's not
a,
just
that was a big
all
piece of
glory.
Legislation.
Right.
But I think John's point, David, is maybe you have a few really huge landmark accomplishments in legislation over the course of your career, and that pulls you from one to the next. Plus, it's not so unpleasant along the way.
I think Dodd-Frank also is probably something people feel like they – rightly or wrongly, it may be a huge disaster piece of legislation, but the people who were involved in creating it thought they were doing something.
And they're
no
longer in Congress.
But the people who have come after who want to try and fix Dodd-Frank or who are involved in immigration reform, they are, it's not like those bills didn't come up. I mean, that's enough in recent memory that you can think, well, I might get my shot for my thing to come up.
All right. Coming up, Facebook changes its privacy settings for teenagers. You're listening to GabFest Radio from Slate and WNYC. This is GabFest Radio. I'm David Plotz along with Emily Bazelon and John Dickerson, and this is the political GabFest portion of the show. Let's move on to our next topic. Facebook this week announced that it was changing its privacy policy for teenagers, so teenage users. I guess you're allowed to use the service when you are 13, Emily, is that right?
Yes, that is right.
13 are now able to post publicly on Facebook, Emily has done a last-minute switch on us and said that we should talk about this. So, Emily, lead our discussion here.
So this is the first time that teenagers can choose to make their posts public. And what got me about Facebook's announcement is this. Well, first of all, they buried this on Wednesday night in the middle of all of the hoopla over Congress, clearly hoping it wouldn't get a whole lot of coverage. And they made a statement about how many young civic activists wanted to be heard. And this was why they need to have their posts public. In fact, the driving force here is that this is very much part of how Facebook is planning to make money. This is about using public posts to help advertisers reach customers. Because, you know, if I like something or I say, hey, I loved going to Idaho on this rafting trip, now my picture and my quote can show up in an ad on Facebook. And this paves the way for that to happen with teenagers as well under Facebook's current privacy policies. That to me is the driving force going on here. And it bugged me that Facebook was trying to pretend otherwise, as if they were serving the interests of teenagers, when in fact, we should then have an argument about whether how much of a change this really is for kids based on the current settings. But I think it's really important to be clear about the dollar sign motivation behind this change.
Up till now, if a kid is posting, a teenager is posting on Facebook, it could be seen by whom?
Friends of friends. So in the past, if you signed up and you were between the ages of 13 and 17, automatically everything you wrote would go to your friends and their friends, unless you went in and made your settings more private. And that was already a very porous setting. You know, think about it. Most people end up networked with hundreds of people on Facebook. If you include all of their networks, you easily get into a very large audience. And so people who work with kids and talk to them about technology have been saying for years, nothing you write on Facebook is private. You can't have that assumption. You have to think that other people are going to see it. So you can argue, as one of our colleagues was this morning, that it's better for kids to know up front, okay, everything's public. I've made that decision. Now I'm going to act accordingly. I think the problem is that most of the time, I don't think kids, when they're posting something incredibly stupid or embarrassing or vicious, have a whole conversation with themselves about whether this is public or private, and they just kind of do it anyway with whatever risk that carries. So the idea that this is going to, you know, help kids exercise better judgment, I'm a little skeptical about. Although I do think it's important to recognize that we're talking about an incremental shift here, not one from privacy to public.
Right. I mean, if kids are posting something stupid or cruel or vicious and it's going to friends and friends of friends, they
it
were
was
posting
going
something
anyway.
Stupid or cruel or vicious that was going to friends and friends of friends. I mean, that's
right.
A lot
and
of
it was really easy. Right. I mean, if you, for example, if you join a group on Facebook and someone else joins that group, they would have access to your post. So it was incredibly easy for people to see what teenagers were posting before this. And I guess you could argue this is more transparent. And also, I should say that now the default setting is not friends of friends anymore. It is just friends. So that was like a pro-privacy move, one I have been advocating along with a lot of other people for a long time, which I was really happy to see. In that sense, what we're talking about here is incremental. And yet, what's really going on here is the idea of more and more habituating people to widespread sharing. And I just think that we need to be clear that the companies that want us to do that so that they can sell what we're posting to advertisers and make money off of us. That's the end goal.
And at that age, is it still true that basically you're far more valuable to an advertiser because, you know, if you buy Crest toothpaste at that age, you're going to be using it your whole life because you basically lock in.
Exactly. And Facebook would like to lock in the loyalty of its users, too, in the same way. Yeah, all of that.
You know what? I don't agree with anything you've just said now that I think about it.
Good. Okay,
like, what's
go ahead.
The big deal? So they're able to market you to advertisers. Big deal. You as a teenager, if your parents have said you can participate in Facebook, you're getting a tremendous benefit out of that. You're getting tremendous access to community, to a kind of modes of discussion and ways to reach people that you never had before, which is
yes.
Awesome. And the fact
and
that
you can
also reach out to the public.
Cool
I have this daughter who is a, you know, she's avid on Facebook. She's not even 13 yet. Whoops. Oh, well. some parent has apparently given too early permission. But she's obsessed with standardized testing, and she has a Facebook page which is devoted to standardized testing, which she wants seen by the world. She is an activist who wants her Facebook activity seen by the world. Seems
yeah, she's
perfectly
a great example.
Fine to me that's happening.
But isn't that the better example? Isn't the better example that if you are an activist and you have a parent who understands and grooves with your activism, that there is a method that should be mildly difficult to then open you up to the world, but that the default position for people of an age that we usually protect in some ways shouldn't be everything to the world.
Right. And also, should we be concerned about the kids who are not your virtuous, politically active daughter, but who are posting things that are going to hurt them later in life when they're following them around forever and they're searchable and seeable by absolutely everyone? I feel like I made mistakes as a teenage journalist, that I'm really glad nobody can go back and really easily find right now. There's a way in which the whole
That would be a great
shield,
project for somebody.
It's going to be very exciting, honestly. I'm making it sound better than it was. But I'm sure I wrote something that I'd be embarrassed now. And the whole project of growing up and of trying out different identities and doing things that later on would cause problems, that's like more and more just completely impossible.
Emily was
neo-Nazi Emily.
Yeah,
she little neo-Nazi Emily.
Promiscuously ending sentences with prepositions.
Why isn't it the case that standards will change and people say, you know what? Emily did that when she was 14 years old. God, she was such a little twerp. Who cares?
Yeah, you always bring up this idea and I find it totally unconvincing because when people do really embarrassing, humiliating things, we are still going to be interested in that. When is the day we're going to be like, oh, ho, hum, that guy Anthony Weiner, who posted that picture of his penis, we just don't care. It's over. We're beyond that. I don't think so. I think when you really give people digital evidence, particularly photos or videos in which they are completely screwing up, we are going to stay obsessed with that.
Although when I got an email from there's some profile of Anthony Weiner somewhere, it was as I deleted it as if it had been like a sales advertisement for an electric sock washer. I mean, I couldn't
but
have deleted it faster.
You know, hate just that whole story.
Well, just like, but no, I right, which I think contradicts your point, which is like, so yesterday's news.
Well, about him in particular, but the next person who does it, we will be interested in. I just think we are expecting kids to grow up really fast and putting all the onus on them to protect themselves online. And the other thing that's important about Facebook as opposed to Twitter. So on Twitter, the default is already public, right? And kids are all over Twitter posting all kinds of stuff. But often the really dumb, bad stuff is not in their real name. Now, on Facebook, this is the place that requires real names. So this really is going to follow you around forever in a way that can be tracked back to you.
Well, you make eloquent arguments, and I'm largely persuaded. Although I would say it seems to me that the solution is not let's bang on Facebook for making things now public. It's more like no one should be allowed to use Facebook until they're 18 years old by this standard.
You know, what I'm more interested in that, because it seems to me like that horse has left the barn, is what the Federal Trade Commission is doing. So they have investigated Facebook in the past, made Facebook change other moments in which Facebook has had user content and then done something with it that went against the previous privacy understanding. The FTC has said, no, we can't do that. Sorry. So now the FTC is taking another look at these privacy policies. And I guess what troubles me, and it's true for adults as well as kids. If you post something to what you thought was a small group or you assumed no one was really listening and you said something and then it ends up like on an advertisement somewhere, is there something about pulling that out of context in a way that you should separately have to grant permission for? I mean, Facebook is now saying, well, you implicitly did give permission when you made your settings public, but people don't think through all those decisions every time. And so I just wonder if the government needs to be taking a closer eye at steps like this and figuring out how to step in here.
That'll do it for the Political Gabfest portion of the show. You'll find a longer version of the show with more topics at slate.com/podcasts. I'm David Plotz in Washington. The Culture Gabfest starts now.
This is Gabfest Radio. I'm Stephen Metcalf. On this week's Slate Culture Gabfest, the new thriller, Captain Phillips. It stars Tom Hanks, it's thoughtful, it has no CGI, and it's being raved upon. And then, does the SAT essay section turn high school students into little BS artists? Something has to, right? And then finally, we discuss the delightful announcement that Alice Munro is the recipient of the 2013 Nobel Prize for Literature. Joining me today is Slate's deputy editor, Julia Turner. Hello, Julia.
Hi, Steve.
And of course, Slate's film critic, Dana Stevens. Hey, Dana.
Hey, Steve.
Captain Phillips is the new thriller from director Paul Greengrass, veteran of the Bourne franchises, and the actor Tom Hanks. It's based on the true story of the capture by Somali pirates of an American container ship and the subsequent hostage standoff, at the center of which is none other than Captain Phillips, played by Tom Hanks. Well, why don't we start by listening to a clip from the movie, and then we can dig in.
Four pirates on board. Four pirates coming towards us down the main deck. Lock down the bridge.
Yeah.
Listen up. We have been boarded by four armed pirates. You know the drill. We stay hidden no matter what. I don't want any hostages.
Soccer, soccer.
We stay locked down until help arrives. No one comes out until you hear the non-duress password from me, which is supper time.
I think listening to that scene gives you an idea of what a chaotic experience it is to watch this movie. It's not just the jolting camera, which is constant, including in scenes that, in my opinion, don't need quite so much jolting. But there's also just overlapping dialogue, untranslated Somali. There's a lot going on in every scene in this movie. And so it keeps you constantly off center as a viewer.
All right, so the movie's definitely a little on the jolty side. But Dana, this movie is getting a lot of love. Are you included in that circle of adulation?
I guess I wouldn't say adulation, no. I mean, this is a very visceral, exciting thriller that completely wraps you up and carries you along for its entire running time. Tom Hanks is great, and I think will probably get an Oscar nomination and maybe win the Oscar. He's extraordinary, as is the previously unprofessional actor Barkhad Abdi, who plays the chief of the Somali pirate crew. But I think this movie has its problems, too. Maybe we can get a little bit into what they are. It is probably my favorite Paul Greengrass movie, along with the two Bourne movies he directed, which are the second and third, and his first movie, Bloody Sunday. But I sometimes get a little bit over the Paul Greengrass shaky cam thing, not only because it spawned so many annoying imitators and nobody can hold their camera still anymore and tripods have been thrown into the ocean worldwide in imitation of his style. He's the only one who can do it. He can carry it off. But I don't think it's necessary for every single moment in every single movie.
Yeah, I mean, mm-hmm. In this film, it works pretty well, right? Because you spend the whole second half of it basically stuck in this tiny bouncing lifeboat where they've taken him hostage. And I think it's not a spoiler since these are based on real events, which our listeners have probably read about in the news. And I think if there's any environment where a shaky cam is called for, it is on the shakiness of the ocean. It sort of works in this film perhaps better than it might in some others. But yeah, I think my problems with the film, which I generally liked and thought was tense and remarkably thoughtful and sympathetic to the position of the Somali pirates, had less to do with the camera work and more to do with characterization. I think that the characterization on both sides is fairly thin. Both the characterization of Captain Phillips sort of relies on our fondness for Tom Hanks, and the characterization of the pirates, which is fairly sympathetic, doesn't really get much beyond their position in the world is desperate, and thus they are pirates.
I guess this is a question that's really dividing critics on the film. A lot of people, including Manuela Dargis for The Times, really do adore this movie and think that it's this sort of incredibly humanitarian thriller, that it's essentially, as was the case with United 93, Paul Greengrass's recreation of 9/11, that without sort of apologizing for the bad guys, right, the bombers in the case of United 93 and the pirates here, that there's some sense that Greengrass goes out of his way to give some sense of their position, where they come from. You can see them at the very beginning in a brief scene essentially bargaining for the job. It's they're like day laborers bargaining with this warlord in Somalia to try to get a spot on the pirate crew. Steve, what did you think? Did you think that this movie went further than your average thriller about hijacking to show some sympathy for the perpetrators as well as the victims?
Well, have you noted that I'm being strangely silent during this segment? I mean, I don't have...
I just assumed that was because you were the strong silent type as the captain of this podcast.
If only that were the case. I mean, the truth is it's because I'm silenced by my own ambivalence about the movie. I didn't have strong feelings about it one way or another. I thought it was admirable that the economic desperation of the pirates appears to be what motivates them. We're not inspired to hate them and root for their slaughter. That said, I found that there was an interesting underside to that, which is that though I wasn't inspired to hate them for their racial otherness, I was inspired to think about the social circumstances that turned them into pirates. I also felt that there was something about the lawlessness of the high seas that the Hanks character is meant to counter, act as a kind of counterpoint to. He's not an especially
heroic person to begin with, right? He's kind of a day job sort of guy, and that's the peg of the thriller, right? Is his coping skills in the face of the unexpected. But he represents a kind of steadiness, lawfulness, procedural sense of duty, and on and on and on. And that was good. But it also, oddly enough, it made me root for the presence of American power in a way. A lot of people say that the massive discrepancy in proportion between the Somali pirates, who have a bunch of automatic weapons and a couple of skiffs, right, and the Navy, which eventually shows up at the end with every high-tech device, including pilotless drone and you know, all kinds of sonar and radar and everything, the whole, you know, the dreadnought or whatever it is that appears that just, you know, tricked out to the nines, is meant to make you sympathetic to the pirates. I actually found the effect of the movie quite the opposite. Something about, if the movie's about lawlessness taking over, you root for the reimposition of law in a way that made me feel, just purely as a person being manipulated by the film, it made me want Pax Americana to descend upon the scene and restore law and order in a way that I found actually quite disturbing. Did anyone else feel this, or am I just out on a limb completely?
When the movie concluded in the theater, there were like three or four people behind me who were like, woohoo, and clapped, which was just so incongruous. And it was like, you guys did not get the memo or the point of this film. I mean, I think the movie is, you know, fundamentally a tragedy with the pirates as the heroes, wrapped up in the guise of a heroic story about a kind of noble American guy and his rescue by American power.
I mean, I think critics like Dargis, who really loved it, read it as an anti-heroic film. I think they would say, you know, there is no hero in this film, that there's an ambiguity to the dreadnought that descends at the end, as Steve put it, and that the trauma that we witness at the end, without spoiling the last scene, I think the last scene is the best part of the film after Richard Phillips is rescued, which we all know he was because he went on to write a book about it on which this is based. So that's not spoiling anything. But what happens to him then, I think, is, for one thing, the thing that's going to get Tom Hanks all this awards attention. But also, I think the moment that lifts this movie above the sort of fist-pumping America, get the pirates resolution that it might have seemed like to those people behind you in the theater, there's really a sense of unresolved trauma and kind of tragedy on all sides.
The movie is called Captain Phillips. It stars Tom Hanks as the title character. It's directed by Paul Greengrass. It sounds like we're on the fence. You guys in our audience, go look at it. Tell us what you think. Maybe you'll knock us onto one side of the fence or the other. Coming up, take out your number two pencils. We'll be turning to the SAT's essay section. You're listening to GabFest Radio from Slate and WNYC. This is GabFest Radio. I'm Stephen Metcalf, along with Dana Stevens and Julia Turner, and this is the Culture GabFest portion of the show. If you'd like to find links for things we mention on the program, we collect them at our show page, wnyc.org/GabFest. And please, if you would, leave us a comment. Tell us what you think of the show. We'd love to hear. That's wnyc.org/GabFest. All right, well, moving on. As part of the 3-hour and 45-minute ritual of taking the SAT, one must now spend 25 minutes writing an essay. What started, no doubt, as an admirable attempt to make the test less standardized, less rote, less Procrustean, to use a SAT word, less generally inhuman, has ended in the predictable disaster. So argues a tremendously not terrible essay up right now on Slate called We Are Teaching High School Students to Write Terribly. It's written by the improbably named author Matthew Malady. And in the piece, he quotes...
Don't forget his awesome middle initials. Matthew X.J. Malady, I believe, is the
it's
official
It's J.X.,
byline.
I think.
J.X.
Anyway, he quotes a writing professor from MIT who says, what this is actually teaching is the ability to bullshit on demand. And that writing teacher goes on to say, what they are really measuring is the ability to spew forth as many words as possible in as short a time as possible. And it seems like it's training students to become politicians. Or one could add GabFest hosts. Julia, presumably, I know you took the SAT, I'm doing the math in my head here, about 5 years ago. Was there an essay section on it when you took it?
No, Steve. I'm practically as old and wizened as you. There was no essay whatsoever on the test when I took it. But can you please use Procrustean in an analogy? Procrustean is to Aristotelian as peaches are to...
Robert Frost.
Okay. Good. I'm glad we've got that sorted. I was conflicted about how I felt about this essay. If I had been given this essay as a prompt for my own SAT essay and asked to write a 25-minute essay either agreeing or disagreeing with it, I am not sure which side I would have selected. I would have been torn. Because on the one hand, I think it is probably true that students being trained for this SAT, this portion of the SAT, are encouraged to develop some bad habits. On the other hand, I think the focus in this essay on the fact that students are sometimes encouraged to not be concerned about whether the facts they are marshaling for these essays are true, and that they are sometimes encouraged to argue the opposite of what they truly believe, this essay presents those two things as mortal sins. And I don't think they're mortal sins at all. If you are going to be a dexterous writer and a persuasive creator of arguments, you should be able to argue anything well and succinctly and efficiently. And that seems like a useful skill. I think basically I'm arguing that bullshitting is a useful skill. And that
this is unexpectedly, this is a grim peek behind the curtain of Slate.com.
Oh, come on.
And Dana, let me turn to you for a second. It seems to me the scandal of this essay isn't the terrible habits that high school students are being forced to ingrain themselves with in order to do this essay. Well, it's what's the real scandal is the graders have absolutely no time to spend on any particular essay before giving it a grade of either 1 to 6, I think, or some, you know, Procrustean scale. And therefore, the grader not only won't look up facts or check if a word is actually used correctly, they really can't do anything more than skim the essay in something like, they're rewarded for taking less than a minute. So it encourages everyone in the entire supply chain to be as shallow as possible. Surely this is not a conscientious way of evaluating talent and sorting it into its appropriate destination college.
I think more than making me sad for the bullshit level of high school seniors, this made me sad for just the importance that standardized testing has in our culture and how much weight is on this test that by definition nobody has the chance to think about, write about, examine, ponder, or evaluate. And it's all rushed through, turned into a number, and then that number is used to determine that student's eligibility for college. It just seems like the very last phase of this testing-crazed education that the kid has been going through for the last 12 years. And I found the whole thing very depressing.
Yeah, I mean, it does seem to me, Julia, maybe it's another nail in the coffin of standardized testing, which is getting a worse and worse rap with every passing year. I mean, my sense is that this piece, which I actually do think is superbly well written, but it does feel maybe a little late because so many universities are now saying we're not even going to consider the SAT when we consider an applicant's merits.
Is that true? Are there many colleges that completely discard?
Yeah, some very good colleges are starting to get rid of it. They see what a foolish exercise this whole thing has been.
Right, but I think that also draws a distinction between, you know, elite students who come from places with lots of resources and privilege and are applying to super top schools that feel like they can afford to spend a lot of time on the admissions process and not use the handy sorting mechanism that is the SAT, and sort of the bulk of American students who are trying to go to college. And I think for most of them, for the vast majority of them, the SAT is still a primary sorting mechanism. If you're choosing between an SAT and no SAT, probably a world with no SAT is better. But if you're choosing between an SAT that includes writing as a skill that should be valued and taught and an SAT that doesn't, I would tend to suspect that one that does spend some human evaluation time on encouraging students to write and to learn to write and encouraging high school curriculum to focus on writing in some capacity is better than the alternative.
All right. Well, we'll agree to disagree, Julia Turner. Let's leave it there. Moving on. Alice Munro has won the Nobel Prize for Literature. Ms. Munro is the Canadian short story writer with a Chekhovian eye and a deadpan pen. There are so many things to say about this. She's the first Canadian to win the Literature Prize. It's not a willfully obscure or political choice. And most of all, it's a selection that has made very many people very happy. Now, none of us on the panel is yet an accomplished Munrovian, so we decided to consult with someone who is. We're joined by the writer and critic Megan O'Rourke, author of The Long Goodbye and a longtime veteran Slatester. She was my first editor here. Megan O'Rourke, welcome back to the show.
It's such a pleasure to be back.
Yeah, it's such a pleasure to have you. Megan, where to start with Alice Munro? Writers whose reputation is huge in some ways, and of course now it's insuperably huge, right? At the same time, when you begin to read her prose for the very first time, it's actually quite modest, right? And you realize that these charms are going to work on you slowly and over time, and the a suggestion is they lie very, very deep. What do you make about her work and her winning this prize?
I think it's great that she's won the prize. And I think it's one of the things that I'm interested in the prize is the cultural response to the prize. You know, as you started to get it, there are these two camps. There are the longtime fans who are avid on behalf of her excellence. And then there are her detractors, like Bret Easton Ellis, who tweeted something negative about her, who think that she writes kind of small, domestic, boring, quote-unquote New Yorker as a, you know, not a nice word, stories. I think her stories are, as you say, deceptively complex and deep and disturbing. And she's often called a Chekhovian writer, which she very much is, but one of the fascinating things about her work is how if you look at the bare-bone outlines of the stories, they're almost melodramatic, right? There's often these girls who run away. There's mistaken long-lost twins. There's kind of secret abortions. There's a kind of O. Henry quality to her writing, too. And I think this is one of the places we can see what a good writer she is that she takes what really would be melodrama in another writer's hands. She turns them into incredibly subtle works.
Mm. You know, I think it was Voltaire who said, "Oh Lord, make my enemies ridiculous." And we could all only beg to have Bret Easton Ellis as the person deriding us on Twitter after we win the Nobel Prize. But I love what you're getting at here, which is that unlike some writers who take the very small and enlarge it artificially, she actually takes things that are inherently dramatic, right? And yet she finds as Emily Dickinson said, a slant way, but also it's something even subtler than slant, right? She finds this very unperturbed point of entry so that you have to go through the motion of the story in order to get at what the drama really is. She's an extraordinary truth teller.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think one of the things that I think is interesting about her, you know, when she won the Nobel, I was saying to somebody, you know, people are going to say this is a less political, you know, that she's a less political writer than some of the writers who have won the Nobel. But in a way, she is a political writer. I mean, she was writing about, largely about women's experience, but not just women's experience. She's writing about small town, lower middle class mores, mostly white, people who, you know, are not making lots of money. But she's really a chronicler of a certain kind of middle class and lower middle class and small town experience that is not postmodern or cool, but I think she does it in a very matter-of-fact way. So that's part of what is so unnerving about her story, is that you think you're going along in one story and then this kind of dramatic turn happens, but it happens very in a really matter-of-fact way. Someone dies, but it just kind of happens. So those are things I love about her work.
Something that really struck me reading some stories in preparation for this segment is how little her prose draws attention to itself. There's no such thing as a fancy sentence that you can pull out and quote. You know, there's not a lot of sort of description, that everything moves forward in a very kind of matter-of-fact way. There's lots of dialogue that's very natural, just the way people talk. And so there's a kind of transparency to her prose where you don't stop and say, wow, that woman can write. It's more the cumulative effect at the end of the story.
Yeah, I'm grateful this year to the Nobel Prize for having prompted me to encounter the works of an artist that I've long heard good things about but haven't spent much time with in the past. But I'm curious more generally to check in on what you guys think about the endeavor of a global prize of Kroner for great literature. Do we think that the Nobel Prize for Literature is a good thing? Are we glad that it exists? Do we think that the annual conversation about it is worthwhile and good for literature, or is it a little bit silly?
You know, I edited a piece about the Nobel Prize for The New Yorker many years ago, or helped edit. And, you know, what really struck me, just that it's very clear there's so much, you know, politics goes into this, right? It really is a prize where there's a committee and there's kind of favors being traded back and forth. And, you know, it's a very idiosyncratic prize in that way.
The thing that strikes me about the Nobel is just, I mean, this all comes from that great book, The Economy of Prestige, about prize culture that I read, that I think I also endorsed on the show. But just that the Nobel is sort of the Ur prize that lends all other prizes meaning. It's sort of the ultimate, right? To get a Nobel Prize is sort of the ultimate lifetime recognition. It's the first sentence in your obituary if you win a Nobel Prize. And essentially all other prizes sort of flow from and borrow their prestige from that one. And so the kind of absoluteness of the Nobel Prize is something that always strikes me every year when it's announced. And the joy that people feel that Alice Munro won it. You can have all these questions about the prize. You can roll your eyes at the absurdity of, you know, prize culture. But still, you know, when somebody from your side, a writer that you love, somebody that represents something you care about, wins that prize, you can't help but sort of feel that, you know, they've achieved some sort of meaning.
Yeah, and the amazing thing about the Nobel Prize for Literature, at least, is that it's undented year after year, no matter how many times they screw it up and get it wrong, right? And people turn around and have accused us, particularly me, of saying, well, they don't pick Americans, they don't pick people that you know. No, I mean, but they didn't pick Tolstoy, for God's sake. They didn't pick Chekhov. I mean, and the people that they picked in their stead are not writers of comparable stature by any means whatsoever. And yet you're right, Dana, there's something incomparably kind of awesome in the traditional sense of the word about the prize. Like, it just can't drain itself of its prestige.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think one thing that I find slightly frustrating about it is one reason the Oscars are fun. I know they're not for Dana, but the reason the Oscars are fun for me is that I feel qualified to comment on the choices, right? I've usually seen a bunch of those movies. I can agree, disagree. And the notion of trying to take a year's worth of Hollywood product and single out things that are good or worthy within it, that seems like a doable exercise. But the notion of an annual prize for lifetime achievement in all of literature, in all languages, in all of the world, seems like so many apples to apples. It seems like the number of people in the world capable of truly evaluating that entire body of bodies of work and coming up with a just decision, and then the number of people able to evaluate the aptness or inaptness of that prize seems so minute. I feel like I can't really even comment on it or grapple with it mentally so that it feels like less of a fun game for us all to play at the end of the year and more like this decree from on high that I can't really disagree with or agree mm-hmm. with particularly.
I'll take it even one step further, though. I mean, what you're doing is essentially you're borrowing, as the Nobel Committee, you're borrowing from the work of posterity, right? Which is only, if we've learned one lesson over the last 2,000 years, it's that only literary posterity is able, almost by definition, to make these kinds of lasting judgments of literary merit, right? And that a contemporary judgments almost always turn out to be wrong. I mean, the most screamingly obvious one being the fact that no one bothered to make a definitive collection of Shakespeare's plays while the man was alive, right? I mean, they never would have given this prize to Charles Dickens. And now, you know, with the benefit of 100 years plus hindsight, it seems clear that Dickens is in the conversation of one of the five greatest writers of the, you know, fiction writers of the English language who ever lived. And that would have been unthinkable to his contemporaries. I mean, you know, if you want to go in the direction of unthinkability, it's not people doing abstruse, highly self-conscious literary work. It's J.K. Rowling and Stephen King and on and on. And I'm not saying these people deserve a Nobel Prize in Literature, but in 100 years, it won't surprise me if someone like that has leaked through.
Maybe we'll have class television as literature by then. Mm-hmm. And we'll all be kicking ourselves for not awarding David Simon for The Wire.
Anyway, Megan O'Rourke, it is always just a total pleasure having you on the show. I hope you can return soon. All right, well, now is the moment in our show where we endorse. All right, let's go around the table. Dana Stevens, what do you have?
I am going to endorse something that came across my Twitter feed yesterday that was by far the most delightful musical moment I've had this week. It was courtesy of my friend John Flad, who correctly guessed that I would love this link. And it's a link to someone's Tumblr. Maybe someone else can tell me more about this piece of music. But it's six young Icelandic men standing in a German train station, which is this big vaulted kind of cathedral-like space, singing this medieval hymn that seems to be in maybe old Icelandic or Latin. I can't tell. But they're singing this ancient hymn a cappella and with polyphonic harmony, and it's fantastic. It's just such a beautiful performance moment. And there's kind of these commuters standing around. And then the moment that it's over, this 2 or 3 minute hymn is over, one of the young guys just, you see that he's holding this bottle of beer and he takes a big triumphant swig. And it's a really wonderful ending to this clip. So we'll put that on our show page.
Dana, correct me if I'm wrong. You've got a PhD in comp lit from Berkeley. Is that correct?
Yes.
And you don't know the difference between old Icelandic and Latin? Okay, you're never coming on this show.
Pack up your desk.
That's wonderful. That sounds fantastic. Julia Turner, what do you got?
I, this week, would like to endorse a book. It is a beautiful book that makes the case through its beauty for the future existence of paper books. It is called Shady Characters, The Secret Life of Punctuation, Symbols, and Other Typographical Marks. And it's by a guy named Keith Houston, who is a medical infographic designer by day, but a couple years ago started writing this very scholarly, nerdy, wonderfully precise and specific blog about the history of punctuation marks. And that blog has been turned into a book. And reading it is delightful for a number of reasons, mostly because it gives you the sense that very obscure, minute bits of history are, in fact, recoverable and discoverable, that there are scholars ferreting out little bits of information all over the world, and that if you're interested, you can troll through many libraries and put the stories back together again. In particular, I loved the chapter on the history of the at symbol, which isn't exactly a punctuation mark, but is a typographical mark. In Danish and Swedish, it's named after the elephant's trunk. In Dutch, it's named after the monkey's tail. In Czech and Slovak, it's named after a roll mop herring. In German, it's named after a spider monkey. In Hebrew, after a strudel or roll-shaped bun. A worm in Hungarian, a pig's tail in Norwegian, or a rose in Turkish. That is just one fact on page 88 of this book, and basically every page of this book is filled with such interesting facts.
Wow. Oh
my God, I want that book so much, I may snatch it out of your hands and run.
Dana is, like, leaning forward in her chair with, like, a fervent look in her eye. Like, I've never really felt like
roll mop herring, you say?
Clutch my possessions to my chest.
Fantastic. All right, well, I'm just going to throw a bunch of stuff out there really quickly. The first is that the Green Acres pie stand is open in Livingston. Friends of mine went there just yesterday, proclaimed it the best pie they've ever eaten. They're just still killing it there. You can email us at Facebook, and I'll give you the proper address. And then finally, I've got to endorse the Robert Frost poem, October. I've only just discovered it. It's amazing. My favorite line is, "Heart's not averse to being beguiled. Beguile us in the way you know." I love Robert Frost. He never stops delivering a great poetry about autumnal pleasures. Yeah. All right. Well, Dana, thank you so much.
Thanks, Steve.
Julia, thanks. That was a pleasure.
As always,
an autumnal one.
You'll find links to some of the things we talked about on today's program at wnyc.org/gabfest, where you can also leave a comment. And you'll find the longer podcast versions of our shows on iTunes, SoundCloud, wherever you get your podcasts, just search for Slate GabFest. GabFest Radio is a production of Slate.com, which is solely responsible for its content. The producers are Sally Herships, Chris Wade, and Mike Vorlo. Our interns are Rebecca Cohen and Anna Schechtman. And the executive producer is Andy Bowers. For everyone at the GabFest crew, I'm Stephen Metcalf. We'll talk to you next week.